you'll see that America is still the land of the free.
Welcome to the Voice of Freedom, your national beacon of liberty. Now, here's your Voice of Freedom, Brent Johnson.
André van Heerden has been working as a film documentarian for more than 15 years. In that time, he has produced, written, and directed dozens of TV programs and numerous documentaries. Most notably, André directed several films and co-produced the Left Behind movie series. Let's welcome to the show André van Heerden.
Hello, how are you guys?
I have to tell you, what attracted me to you as a guest for this show is that you claim that there has been new evidence unearthed that rocks evolution theory. Can you expound on that?
I can indeed. Actually, there's two parts to this, too. It's a documentary called Dragons or Dinosaurs. It primarily looks at the evidence of dragon legends supporting firsthand accounts with people with dinosaurs. Now, dragon legends have been around for a long time, so that's one part of it, and I'll come back to it. The second part, and it links into this, is the discovery of soft tissue inside dinosaur bones. Basically, there were paleontologists who were out in the field. They were looking at, they found some dinosaur bones, actually of a Tyrannosaurus rex, very well-known dinosaur, probably the most famous of all the dinosaurs. And there was a femur bone, a leg bone, that was stuck in a piece of rock, and so they were trying to get it out of there. When they were trying to remove it, they pulled back on it and they broke it. And when they broke it, they looked inside of it, and they found that there was soft tissue, bone marrow, inside this petrified bone. Now, immediately you say to yourself, logically, there's no possible way that there's going to be any soft tissue of any sort, of any kind, inside a bone that's supposedly 65 or older, million years old. The longest soft tissue would survive is a few thousand years old. A few thousand, I'm talking under 10,000 years, compared to millions of years. It's a massive gap. And since then, they've actually found other dinosaur bones, a hadrosaur bone, that also has soft, pliable tissue inside the bones.
Is it possible that this soft substance could have been the result of, I don't know, some kind of insects, larva, or, you know, something that dissolves hardness? Could it be some kind of process whereby it's not the original bone marrow, but it's just some substance that's been softened by some kind of process, fauna process? I don't know what I'm talking about here.
Actually, you sound quite learned, because that's actually an excellent question. And it's a question that they immediately tried to answer, because I should point out, the people who found this bone aren't people who were looking to say, wait a minute, this bone is very young. The person who found it, in fact, is Dr. Mary Schweitzer. Now, she works with Dr. James Horner. Anyone who has heard of the movie Jurassic Park will be familiar with the lead scientist, and that scientist in that movie was actually based on James Horner. So we're not talking about just a run-of-the-mill, unknown scientist trying to make a name for themselves. This guy is known as Dr. Dinosaur, and the person he works most closely with is Dr. Mary Schweitzer. These are people who both believe very firmly in the theory of evolution and the world being millions and millions of years old. So this is not something they were looking for. In fact, it is something they did not want to find. So when they found the soft tissue, they said, well, we should do some tests on this. It has to be some sort of bacteria, or it has to be some sort of inserted thing, or it has to be some way of magically preserving it over these millions and millions of years. Before Mary Schweitzer published her findings on this, she did 17 tests. 17. So pretty thorough, way more than would usually be done. And she published it in the magazine Discovery, and since then she's been getting a lot of pressure and a lot of criticism from fellow scientists saying this can't be true, and she's saying, okay, what else would you like me to do? And they suggest something, and she's been doing it. And eventually she said, tell me what else to do. And they said, you know what, there is nothing you can do to prove to us that what you've found is there. It is a case of scientists, supposedly people who are supposed to be objective, saying, no matter what you show me, I will not believe that that bone is young, which is very unscientific. They're putting their belief, their personal belief systems, ahead of the actual observable.
Well, have,
Can I interject here? This reminds me of a Bill Hicks sketch where he talks about how Christians believe that the Bible says that the world is 12,000 years old, and oh, Jesus stepped down towards Nazareth, but the trail was blocked by a giant brontosaurus. Is it possible that human beings and dinosaurs ever coexisted together for a time?
Well, that is exactly what this documentary is saying. And at first, you know, when you hear this, you say, oh, this is sensational. But let's stop there for a moment. Why do we think that is so sensational? Well, it's because we're taught as very young children and through all the media and stuff that dinosaurs are millions and millions of years old. Where does that belief come from? Well, when you find a dinosaur bone, most paleontologists will say, okay, the rock layer that the bones are found in are 65 million years or 70 million years old, and therefore the bones must be 65 to 70 million years old. Okay, well, how do we know then that the rocks are that old? Well, because dinosaur bones are found in them, and we know dinosaur bones are that old. There's a problem with that logic. You're never going to be wrong. The rocks are old, therefore the bones are old. The bones are old, therefore the rocks are old. Well, okay, let's stop for a second. You're basing that assumption on circular logic. Now, here's the other part to it, and it's a very troubling question for anyone who believes that man did not walk with dinosaurs. There are literally thousands of legends of dragons, large reptilian creatures, all around the world. How would you describe a dragon? Ask anyone on the street, they'll say a large reptile-like creature with sharp teeth, claws, scales on the back, some have wings, some breathe fire. Okay, how would you describe a dinosaur? Large reptile creature with teeth, with claws, some have wings.
Without the fire.
I'll hold off on the fire because there's actually some evidence for that as well, too. So if you suddenly look at these dragon legends and you look at, okay, they're in South America, they're in Australia, they're in China. If you look at the zodiac, you know, the Chinese zodiac, and you're born in the year of the goat or the year of the pig, there are 14 animals there. Of the 14, 13 are very ordinary goat, pig, dog, all that sort of rat. There's only one that people would say would be mythological. There's the dragon, the year of the dragon. Well, what's that doing in there with all the other ones that are supposedly or that are regular animals? So you look at the Chinese culture and their legends. You look at St. George and the dragon, and you suddenly realize, wait a minute, not only does every single culture on the face of the planet have these legends, but they all describe very similar creatures. Now, this is going back hundreds of years ago, and this is going back before they'd have time to communicate, and hundreds of years before anyone had even thought there were such a thing as dinosaurs. So how are they all describing a similar creature over vast amounts of time and space? Before paleontology, the only answer, logical answer, and I'll give you a kind of humorous other possibility, but the only logical answer is that they actually, these creatures and those legends are based on those historical creatures, which we would now call dinosaurs.
If the dragons and the myths about dragons that have spawned some of the most entertaining science fantasy works ever, if indeed these creatures were real, okay, and I'm frankly one who's willing to believe, what does that mean for us today? What did these discoveries mean in terms of practical application to what we know about our planet today?
There are huge implications. First off, when you say, I believe that the world is between 6,000 and 10,000 years old, people really look at you strangely. Believe me, I know. Because they immediately go, okay, you're a creationist nut. You don't believe in science. Well, the first thing I would say is, have you heard of Newton, possibly the world's greatest scientist? Have you heard of Johannes Kepler? Have you heard of Louis Pasteur? Have you heard of Michael Faraday? These are all not just Nobel Peace Prize winners in science. They're actually the founders, the founding fathers of science as we know it today, and they all believed in biblical creation. So you can't say, hey, you believe in the Bible or you're a Christian, therefore you can't believe in science. No, no, no. It's the science of one religion, a belief in God and creation, versus the science of another religion, which would be a belief in nothing. The statement, I do not believe in God, is as religious as a statement of, I believe in God. Both are religious statements. In our world today, people would like to say that one is and one isn't. And I'll take this a step further. When I mentioned about these dragon legends being a real problem for people who believe that dinosaurs and man didn't walk together, one of the world's most famous evolutionists, Richard Dawkins, was asked about this. You know, how do you explain all these legends over vast amounts of time and space? How can they all be describing the same creature? And he wrote a book called Dragons of Eden, and he tried to explain it this way. And you tell me which sounds more likely, that people actually walked with dinosaurs and that they called them dragons, or that 65, 70 million years ago, when we were just little reptiles and pond scum, somehow we saw these huge creatures, these big scary creatures, and we remembered them as, you know, these little reptiles. And then as we evolved over millions of years, that memory was passed on from, you know, a rodent to whatever, I don't know what comes next, a horse, and then to a chimpanzee. And then eventually, as we became human, somehow we remembered these scary creatures, and therefore we can tell these stories. It's laughable. It's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. You cannot say that I can remember even what my father's memories are. It's impossible. It will not happen. And yet, and this is a guy who has a PhD. He's very intelligent. I'm not trying to insult his intelligence. But he's so desperate to not believe that man and dinosaur could have walked together that he's saying, no, this is what actually happened.
Let me chime in with a moment. Let me take a counter position for just a moment. And by the way, as I say, please, I really am one who wants to believe. But let me take the other position, which is assuming that indeed man walked with dinosaurs, that dragons were real, that these creatures are a part of man's history on Earth. Assuming that's the case, how did we forget about all of it? How did we get to the point? I mean, these are not exactly easy to forget creatures. I would imagine if you've actually walked with a dinosaur, you don't forget the experience too soon, and you pass it on. So how would it be in 6,000 years that we've completely lost the proof of all of this, and it's relegated to the mists of myth and legend?
Again, great question. So I would first say that the proof is actually there. One, the dragon legends. Two, the dragon artifacts. If you look in ancient Egypt, the oldest artifact that we have today, it's this plate from, and I'm not going to pronounce his name correctly, but it's an Egyptian plate. It shows this great Egyptian leader holding up the head of his vanquished enemy, kind of saying, hey, look how cool I am and strong I am. And around him, with some Egyptians with ropes around these creatures' necks, are two. And the term brontosaur, actually, there is no such thing as a brontosaur. It's a misnomer. It's actually called a sauropod dinosaur. But, you know, the biggest ones that you
the
have.
The
ones with the very, yeah, brachiosaur. Very well done. So the ones with the very long necks, the enormous bodies, what, you know, some may call behemoth, the beasts of the beast. But there's these Egyptians. There's a picture of these Egyptians with ropes around these creatures' necks pulling back on it. And you look at it, and anyone today would say, oh, that's a brachiosaur or a sauropod dinosaur, this massive animal. You look in a temple in Cambodia, in the Khmer Rouge region. It's a temple called Angkor Wat. It's 800 years old. It was just recently discovered. It's fantastic. You can look at pictures up online. It's totally overgrown by these trees, very much like Indiana Jones type discovery. And you see there's all these pillars with carvings on it. Some are Buddhist gods and things like that. And then there's this one pillar that has all these carvings on it of animals that we would recognize today. Goats, chickens, all these different things. And there's one carving, you look at it and you immediately say stegosaur. It is a stegosaur, it has the spines of a stegosaur, it's proportionate to a stegosaur, it's a stegosaur. And you say, well, wait a minute, this temple dates back to 1500 BC, huh? Okay, so that's 1,500 years before dinosaurs were ever discovered. It's 65 million years after dinosaurs were supposed to be totally extinct. How could this group of people possibly carve so accurately a stegosaur? So I would argue, and there's a number of other examples of stories, artifacts, paintings, carvings, legends. I would argue that the proof is there. One of the other parts to it, too, is that if you look at history and you say, why hasn't it been documented? It has been, but what happens is that it's discounted. You've heard of Alexander the Great. Everyone's heard of Marco Polo, Flavius Josephus, Pliny the Elder. These are all credible, recognized historians who we generally take all that they say as historically accurate and great descriptions of that time. However, there are certain things that no one hears about because people today were so learned, we say, oh, no, they were just making that up. Alexander the Great describes how he was marching across India with his army, and he came across what he called an elephant eater. Now, he didn't use the term dinosaur because that term only came around in 1840, so it's hundreds of years before 1840. He described it as an elephant eater. It was this enormous, dangerous reptile. It said that he sent his army after it, a number of his foot soldiers after it, and they tried throwing their harpoons into it and tried killing this thing, and it killed his men. So they started launching catapults at this thing, and they basically pounded it into the ground. And then his army went on. And that was it. It wasn't a sensational account. It was an account of, hey, we came across this crazy, dangerous lizard, and then we moved on. You look at
As you do, hey, we're just blasting through the desert and we saw this enormous lizard that was eating elephants, so we killed it and we moved on. You know, it's not something that you want to really get it over in a tiz about, is it? Now, I was wanting to know, what role does carbon dating really have in this process? Because if we're trying to figure out the age of these bones, I would think that carbon dating would be one of the most important processes. What say you?
Absolutely. So one of the things that this documentary looks at is people immediately say, okay, that all may well be true, but if you look at carbon dating, just as you have, what does that say? Well, the terms of dating methods actually get confused quite a bit because they sound a little bit similar. First off, there's carbon dating. And what carbon does is say, okay, we know that carbon, which is in everything, every life, every living creature, carbon is part of it, that when it dies, the carbon escapes from it. So therefore, we can determine by how much carbon is left in this dead or fossilized remain, how much carbon is left there will tell us how old it is. However, carbon only will last for about 50,000 years in anything. So therefore, if you find anything with carbon in it, it has to be younger than 50,000 years. So you'd say, okay, well, what about a diamond? If you date a diamond, it actually comes out to be about 40,000 years old. Now, it's supposed to be one of the oldest substances on the planet. It's supposed to be, 100 million years old. It actually still has carbon in it. How is that possible? So that's the one thing. Carbon dating can't be used. Actually, most paleontologists will not use it on dinosaur bones. I wish they would, because they say it won't have carbon in it because it's too old. So then there's another type of dating method, and this is called radioisotope dating. Now, what radioisotope dating does is it takes a measurement, very similar to carbon dating, but it takes a measurement of the nuclear decay rates of uranium that are left in there. And basically, uranium is the father product, and then the daughter product is the lead. So you're trying to measure how much uranium has leaked out. And if you take a measurement of certain rock samples using radioisotopic dating, you will come out to a very old age. Now, there's a number of problems with that. If you actually go to, say, that Icelandic volcano that just erupted recently and the lava flow that came out of there, so you've actually seen the molten rock come out, you've actually seen it stop and form, you can actually give the date that it actually formed. Hey, this formed in, March of this year, so we know it's only a few months old. If you date that lava flow, it will come out as a very old age, millions of years, despite the fact that you actually watched it being formed. Now,
why?
Why? Well, because the assumption is you have to assume with this rock that there was a certain amount of uranium to begin with, and that's a huge assumption. So when you do that dating, you can say, okay, yeah, we believe that this rock is there for millions of years old. So when you get that dating, you say, that's correct. But if you take another dating method, which actually is a much more accurate measurement of these rocks, and you actually measure the amount of helium, and this is helium that you put into, children's balloons, the amount of helium that is in those rocks, there's a much more accurate way of measuring it. Because when helium escapes from granite, and I'm getting quite scientific here, but the documentary goes into quite a bit of detail on this, you can actually measure how old that is. And this is a scientific process that you can do in a laboratory time and time again. It is a very stable, helium is an inert gas, what's considered an inert gas, so therefore it's not affected by a lot of other things like heat and cold and all that sort of stuff, unlike uranium, which definitely is. Many people theorize that uranium, the dating methods and the amount that it escapes, is greatly affected by water. So if it was, say, under huge amounts of water, say, in a giant flood, that the amount of time would have been sped up.
This whole phenomenon of dinosaurs perhaps living with people will blow the minds and really fascinate many people. Also, at the same time, one would have to wonder why so much accurate documentation is missing from it. And I'm recalling what you said about Alexander the Great finding an elephant eater, and that reminded me of the Library of Alexandria being burned down with all the history books of the world inside it, which basically destroyed the human race's history. How exactly could it come about that over time people will forget everything that once happened to their entire species?
Well, I think it's really a case of one of my favorite quotations is actually by the philosopher Francis Bacon, and he wrote, "People prefer to believe what they prefer to be true." And if you look at, even modern history, there are a very scary group of people who deny that the Holocaust ever happened. And they'll say, you know, this never happened, and, you know, they deny it, despite the fact that the people who actually were part of the Holocaust kept very detailed records on it, that you actually can show the graves of all these people that actually were killed. And yet there's a growing number of people who want to believe that that never happened. Revisionist history is a dangerous thing. And so therefore, if you don't want to believe something to be true, because therefore if you believe, for example, that dinosaurs were created at the same time as every other creature on the planet, including man, and that there was a great flood that covered the world in water and sediment, and if you want to create fossils, what's the best way to create fossils? Massive and massive amounts of sediment burying creatures very, very quickly so that they're preserved in rock. You cannot, and this is a huge problem I have with science classes in high schools today, you cannot form a fossil by a creature just dying out in a field or dying by a river. If you have a pet or something or a cow, you live on a farm and that cow dies, or a creature dies in the ocean, what happens to it? It is scavenged immediately. Within a week, it's, you know, scattered all over the place. Within a month, it's gone. It does not form a fossil. The only way you can form a fossil is by huge amounts of sediment, massive amounts of mud, burying the creature very, very quickly. Now, if you had a global flood with that amount of upheaval, and you had all this sediment, what would you expect to find? Well, you'd expect to find millions and millions of creatures buried all over the face of the earth in layers of sediment. Well,
I can actually elaborate on that. There are 168 cultures around the world that have accurate, records or stories of a great flood. And also, there are hundreds of thousands, not hundreds and thousands, but hundreds of thousands of mountain ranges all around the world that have lots and lots of different types of animal bones all flumped together, including humans and tools and birds, sea creatures, land creatures, all together. So it appears that the Great Flood was very much a very real story.
Well, and more than that, Vinny, what you just brought up brings me to another point. Are you familiar, Andre, with Professor Carl Baugh? He produced a series called Creation in Symphony, probably about 20 years ago. He's out of the Dallas, Texas area. And in it, he provided evidence, substantial evidence, confirmed from numerous sources, that show that they found fossils and they found evidence proving that man and dinosaur lived at the same geological strata, the same time frame. So everything you're saying and what you're saying, Vinny, okay, this is stuff Carl Baugh talked about 20 years ago. So it really does suggest that there is a lot of truth in this observation, in this evidence.
And sometimes, unfortunately, people will see, well, you know, it's out in the jungles of Cambodia. What do they know? Oh, it's all just, you know, opium-inspired people making stuff up. Well, hold on. You know, Alexander the Great, Marco Polo, Pliny the Elder, Josephus, they're real historians. But also, too, when you look at even what's happening in North America, you can find pictographs and petroglyphs. These are either carvings or paintings on rocks of actual representations. And you look at these pictures and you say, well, that's a sauropod dinosaur, or that's a pterodactyl. And you say to yourself, how is it possible that these people are drawing these creatures or are carving these creatures millions of years after they're supposed to be extinct? And the only answer you can come up with is they saw them. And then actually, if you look at, you know, the legends of Loch Ness Monster, and you look at the descriptions that were there, long-necked snaky monster, you ask yourself, well, why haven't I heard more of this? It is the media, it is the people's predisposition to not believe it. I was recently reading a children's book. It's part of a Jack and Annie children's series. And in this series, this little boy and little girl explore different parts of history. And at the end of each of the books, the author writes about her research that she did on that period. And it's fascinating. It's a very enjoyable series. This one book was called Summer of the Sea Serpent. And so this Jack and Annie with this magic tree has go back in time, and they actually end up encountering this giant sea serpent. In the back part, when she's talking about her research, she says she found thousands of stories from years ago of all these sailors claiming to have seen long-necked, snake-like creatures roaming the deep. And then she makes a little note, and she says, more than likely, they mistook a whale, a turtle, or a squid as these creatures. And I stopped, and I asked my children, I said, okay, please describe what a whale looks like. They did, a squid, a turtle, and they were able to describe them. I said, do any of those things look like a long-necked, snake-like, giant creature? I said, no, none of them even have a neck. So how is it possible? And here's another question. If you're a sailor, would you know what a squid is, or a turtle, or a whale? Of course, you're a sailor. You know what those creatures are. So why would we suddenly discount the sailor saying, I saw a long-necked, snake-like monster that was terrorizing my whole crew? Why would we say he's lying? The only reason we would say he's lying and we don't believe him is because we don't want to believe him.
That's something that is permeating throughout the entire human race as we speak. We just simply don't want to know. What I want to know is Hollywood's perspective on all of this. We've got lots and lots of movies where dinosaurs exist alongside man, Jurassic Park, The Lost World, and various other ones that are set back in old caveman days, and they are pitched as fantasy. Now, I was watching RoboCop one time, and I thought to myself, you know what, maybe this is some sort of preparation for people accepting cybernetic organisms, or rather, if cybernetic organisms are put into the public eye, nobody would believe it. And I think very much that's sort of Hollywood's job, is to portray things that are real or may soon be real as a fantasy, so that people will think that when you mention it, oh, it's just a movie, it's just a fantasy.
No, I totally agree, and I think it works both ways. You have art imitating life, or is it life imitating art? And so a lot of times when, you know, Star Trek's a great example. Star Trek, you know, set in the future. But you look at some of their technologies, whether it's their transponder-type things, well, that was before cell phones, and now cell phones have been accepted. One of the things we had looked back on, just going back a few years, was how not only has our technology changed, but also people's perceptions of accepting new technologies or new things changed. It used to be that, you know, I remember this funny story about an escalator, the very first escalator in a shopping mall, and how people, when they got on, they actually gave them a shot of brandy when they got to the top, because they thought, you know, the people were going to be so out of whack having been transported on this escalator. This is a true story. Now, I mean, if you introduce something like that today, people just go, okay, I'll get on it, and they forget about it in a second. The fax machine came, hey, this is neat. Next day, it's not news anymore. The cell phone comes, hey, text messages every single day, we're bombarded with something new, and we immediately accept it. But at the same time, it's dangerous because the lines between fact and fiction suddenly become blurred. So when you say, for example, man and dinosaur live together, and here's the evidence, and it's pretty hard evidence, soft tissue, dragon legends, dragon artifacts, historical experts, documented cases of all this being here. You say, why isn't it mentioned in the Bible? Well, look up Job and look at the description of Behemoth and Leviathan. You tell me what that person's describing. It's certainly not a pussycat. It's a giant, scary reptile. What's a giant, scary reptile? A dinosaur at the same time as the people in the Bible. So that sort of thing, people go, oh, no, that's all just myth and fantasy. And I agree with you that Hollywood and make-believe really starts to blur the line between, hey, what is real and what isn't? And I think people have stopped being able to ask the proper questions and being open to hearing the proper answers.
Yeah, I think that that's very true. This short attention span that we have in so-called developed society really does work against us. Briefly, we're just about out of time. Can you tell us briefly about this newest film?
Sure. It's called Dragons or Dinosaurs. It looks at dragons' legends. It looks at mankind walking with dinosaurs and how dinosaurs are dragons and dragons are dinosaurs. You can find more information about it at our website, cloud10pictures.com. That's cloud10pictures.com.
Now, we have a 60-second clip. Is the film out yet?
It's just come out, yes.
Okay, and what's the name of the film?
Dragons or Dinosaurs.
And here's a clip from it.
Have you heard the story about the terrifying dragon created by God?
Dragons, just the word, conjures up all these images.
They look like big reptiles with long tails with scales, sharp teeth, claws.
They're carnivorous and they're basically going to gnaw your face off.
Could actually be stories about what we today call dinosaurs.
Marco Polo's writing about dragons. Alexander the Great's talking about his giant lizard.
How did the people who carved that stone 800 years ago have carved a stegosaur?
Where in the world did all those images come from?
Do you believe in dragons or dinosaurs?
Try to explain away human encounters with creatures which we would call dragons.
Creation or evolution?
Clearly, science has shown this dinosaur died out very recently.
This is one of the greatest paleontological discoveries ever.
Man or God?
Confirms the Bible's history that dinosaurs and people lived at the same time.
Cloud 10 Pictures proudly presents Dragons or Dinosaurs, DVD and book. Visit cloud10pictures.com today.
And I have to tell you, folks, we've had on this show, we've had biblical archaeologist Jonathan Gray. I have personally interviewed Professor Carl Baugh. The allegations, if you want to call them that, that evolution theory is not true, there's a lot of support for that. There is very, very little modern scientific support for evolution theory. And just imagine what our whole world view would be if we knew for a fact that, say, the stories in Genesis, the stories in Scripture are true. What if we knew for a fact that man and dinosaur walk together on Earth? Our guest has been Andre van Heerden. And Andre, I want to thank you very much for spending time. This is a fascinating topic, and I hope people will check out and obtain and watch this movie, Dragons and Dinosaurs. The website is www.cloud10pictures, and you spell out the word 10, T-E-N, cloud10pictures.com. And Andre, I want to wish you the very, very best in bringing this information to the people of the world.
Well, thanks for having me on. You can probably tell how excited I am about it.
Andre van Heerden, thank you so much for spending this time with us here on the Global Freedom Report.
Thank you for listening to this edition of The Voice of Freedom. Opinions expressed are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the views of Truth and Freedom Radio Networks, Freedom Broadcast Group Incorporated, or our sponsors. For more information about your freedoms and liberties, or to contact Brent, just log on to our website at www.freedomradio.us or call 1-888-385-3733. Join us next time for another lesson in liberty on The Voice of Freedom.
America, land of the free, right to life and liberty. Open your eyes and you will see that America is still the land of the free.